Well, good morning, Fellowship Greenville. It's good to see you. My name is Chris, and you don't recognize me because I'm normally out there where you are. But I kind of like this view, so it's nice to see your faces this morning. I have been a part of Disciple, which is our series this summer, and have been part of building and delivering that and UCC along with Jason and the team. And so I get to give the next installment in that this morning on heart, and had a couple weeks ago, was at Adams Mill, and enjoyed being there with them as well. So we're going to be in Mark 4 today. So if you'll find that in your hard copy or your device, however you do that, we'll also have them on the screens for you if you don't have either. And we'll be looking at that together. As we start... I want to tell you a little story, and it's really called an allegory. And the question is, why would I tell you an allegory? And here's the reason why. Allegories are highly symbolic stories designed to convey kind of semi-hidden or complex or abstract ideas in a way that is a little less direct and gives the opportunity for it to kind of get down inside of our chest cavity. So I'm going to tell you one you've likely never heard before. And as I tell it to you, I want you to be thinking the entire time, what is the meaning of this? What is behind or underneath this big concept that I need to grasp? It's called the keeper of the stream. There was once a town high in the Alps that straddled a bank of a beautiful stream. The stream was fed by springs that were old as the earth and deep as the sea. The water was clear like crystal. Children laughed and played beside it. Swans and geese swam upon it. You could see the rocks and the sand and the rainbow trout that swarmed at the bottom of the stream. High in the hills, far beyond anyone's sight, lived an old man who served as the keeper of the stream. He had been hired so long ago that now no one could remember a time when he was not there. He would travel from one spring to another in the hills, removing branches or fallen leaves or debris that might pollute the water. But his work went unseen. One year, the town council decided they had better things to do with their money than pay someone to keep the stream, even if it did provide life to the town. After all, no one even supervised or watched over the man anyway. They had roads to repair and taxes to collect and other services to offer, and giving money to an unseen stream cleaner had become a luxury they felt they could no longer afford. So the old man was quietly and unceremoniously relieved of his duties, and he left his post. High in the mountains, the springs that fed the stream went untended. Twigs and branches, and worse, muddied the liquid flow. Mud and silt compacted the creek bed. Farm wastes turned parts of the stream into stagnant bogs. For a time, no one in the village noticed. Everyone went about their busy lives, farming and buying and selling and schooling and anything else that got their attention. But after a while, the water was not the same. It began to look brackish. The swans flew away to live elsewhere. The water no longer had a crisp, fresh scent that drew children to play by it. And alarmingly, some of the people in the town began to grow ill. Now everyone noticed the loss of the sparkling beauty that used to flow between the banks of the streams that fed the towns. The life of the village depended on the stream, and the life of the stream depended on the keeper. So the town council reconvened, priorities were realized and adjusted, the money was found, and the old man, the one who was seemingly undervalued and ignored living high in the mountains, was rehired. In time, the springs were cleaned, though there was much difficult work to be done that was not easy or swift. Eventually, the stream returned to its previous purity. Children returned to playing again on its bank, and the town's illnesses were replaced with health. The swans came home. The village came back to life. The life of the village depended on the health of the stream. Now, do you see the meaning? Here's the meaning. The stream is your heart. The village is your life. And you are the keeper. How well are you doing? Proverbs 4:23 says it this way, guard your heart above else, for it determines the course of your life. And I wonder, how strongly do we really believe that? How much do we really believe that the one thing that should get more attention than anything else in this world is our heart? Because out of it flows all of life. So here's the big idea I think we're going to find in Mark 4, and it's this: your life depends on the health of your heart. So care for it with all diligence. We need to hear from Jesus in Mark 4, and we're going to. And as we look at it together, I just want you to know we're not going to kind of scientifically analyze the text. Instead, what I would love is for us to just more experience it. So in order for that to happen, you have to bring yourself to it. So you have to push away all those other things that are competing and really bring your heart to it so that that text can get inside of us. All right? So here we go. Let's read it together. Mark 4, verse 1. Once again, Jesus began teaching by the lake shore. A very large crowd soon gathered around him. So he got into the boat, and then he sat in the boat while all the people remained on the shore, and he taught them by telling them many stories in the form of parables, such as this one. Listen, a farmer went out to plant some seed, and as he scattered it across his field, some of the seed fell on a footpath, and the birds came and ate it. Other seed fell on shallow soil with underlying rock. The seed sprouted quickly because the soil was shallow, but the plant soon wilted under the hot sun, and since it didn't have deep roots, it died. Other seed fell among thorns that grew up and choked out the tender plants, so they produced no grain. Still other seeds fell on fertile soil, and they sprouted, grew, and produced a crop that was 30, 60, and even 100 times as much as has been planted. Then he said, anyone with ears to hear should listen and understand. This is God's word for us today. Thanks be to God. As you heard that parable from Jesus, did you find yourself leaning in, thinking, what does this mean? Or did you find yourself, this is a little check, leaning out? Heard it before? Doubt of its relevance? That's the hook that Jesus is after, is the lean in. So this is the first parable that Mark tells in his gospel, so it stands as priority. It's the only one Jesus fully interprets to his followers. As a matter of fact, his disciples come to him afterward, after he tells the parable, and he's like, hey, Jesus, what in the world did that mean? And Jesus is like, really? Really? You don't get it? Okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to tell you what it means one time, and that's it. You got to keep up. So it's a very challenging one that we have to get. As a matter of fact, in verse 13, Jesus said, if we don't understand this parable, we're not going to understand any of the other ones he's going to tell. So it is of the utmost importance in order to be able to understand it. So as Jesus is doing this, it had been a really long day for him, an emotional day for him. His mother and his brothers had attempted to forcibly take him back home to Nazareth. Why? In order to protect him from himself, because they thought he had gone crazy. The religious leaders had accused him of partnering with Beelzebub. Now, in case you're wondering, that is not a compliment to Jesus' work. So That's been a tough part of the day. Then he shocked everyone by saying that his true mother and brothers were not his earthly relations, but whoever does God's will was his true family. I think it's been a long day, and Jesus needs an afternoon coffee in peace just to relax a little bit, maybe put his feet up. But instead, he goes down to the lake, and he preaches a sermon. Before analyzing the four hearts of the parable, which is what we're going to spend some time doing, I just want to kind of level set what's going on in it so that it'll make a little bit more sense to us as we do. And here's the level set. We're going to ask the question, what are constants in the parable and what are variables? Constants and variables. And here's why. Because when we get clear on that, we'll know where we need to focus in the story as to the meaning, the import that Jesus is giving us. All right? So here's the question. The seed. Is the seed in the parable a constant or is it a variable? It's a constant. This is not a story about good seed or bad seed. You didn't hear anything about that in the parable. The seed is going to take root if it's just given half a chance. So in the story, the seed is Jesus and his word. All right, second question. How about the sower? Is the sower a constant or is the sower a variable? It's a constant, right? This is not a story about good or bad sowing. The one sowing is generous, we're told. He's throwing seed everywhere on every type of soil. He's non-discriminant in that. Okay, how about another one? The weather. Is the weather in the story a constant or a variable? It's a constant in this story. Now, here's what we know. In farming, weather is always the variable, isn't it? I mean, no farmer would ever say, doesn't matter what the weather is, I shall grow a massive plant and crops, right? We're going to have a huge harvest. It is, but in this story, it's not actually a factor. Now, what about the soil? Constant or variable, right? Variable. That's it. That's the one variable in the story. And of course, in the story, the soil is our hearts. So what is Jesus doing in this parable? Here's what he's doing. He's giving us a diagnostic tool to use in evaluating the kind of hearts that we have. Now, I know some of you have heard this parable once, twice, maybe even many times, and you've heard it taught as these are about the unbelievers' hearts versus believers' hearts. I don't actually think that's what Jesus is doing here for many reasons, including the fact that he told his disciples as the primary audience in this and explains it to them. This is not about them versus us. This is about all of us having a diagnostic of what is the state of our heart in regard to the seed of God, of Jesus and his word. How are we responding to it? So this is our chance to do a little diagnostic together, shall we? Here we go. Heart number one, the hardened heart, verse 4, and then Jesus explains it further down in verse 15. It's where he says, some seed fell on a footpath. Now, that won't make much sense unless we understand a little about the agrarian life back in that day. So the farmer fields in ancient Palestine were these long, narrow, serpentine strips divided by little paths. I actually have a picture for it for you to get a little bit of imagination of what it might have looked like. And they become beaten and they become hard as the pavement on as people walk and as hooves go on this path and as wagon wheels even would go down it and they would get bigger and bigger. So imagine a field full of soft soil. And in the beginning, the entire field is fertile, right? And open to receive the seeds and the water. But over time, this path begins to form. It's just narrow line at first, but where people walk occasionally. But over time, with more and more footsteps, the soil gets a little more compacted. The more people and animals walk on it, the harder it becomes. And eventually, that part of the field becomes a dirt trail that's dried. It's trampled. It's unresponsive to anything. So, no matter how good the seed, No matter how helpful the weather, no matter how much the seed is thrown on the path, it's just too hard for anything to penetrate the hardened soil and take root and grow. And of course, this describes a heart that is hardened to Jesus and his words. How do our hearts get there? Well, over time, we experience pain, rejection, betrayal, difficult things, and immediately we feel the sting, which only grows into deeper pain, into a deeper ache that doesn't seem to go away. Our hearts bleed because we're injured. Over time, we experience a deep disappointment that we allow to linger and eventually turns into bitterness. And we nurse that bitterness. And it gets harder, harder. We push back from God and people, resisting gestures of love and kindness, and when the truth is told to us. Quiet promptings from God begin to get ignored to the extent that rarely, if ever, we hear them or welcome them. And we certainly avoid vulnerability because that feels dangerous. We stop trusting. We stop hoping. We stop listening. We stop believing. We stop feeling. When our hearts get walked on over and over again, that pain is left unhealed or unprocessed. We protect ourselves. And in so doing, we become numb. This can happen also by repetitive sin. Now, even when I say that, I know some of us kind of bristle at that. One way of understanding sin that we don't probably talk about as much is that it's toxicity. It's really self-poisoning. And that is to say, God has given us a way to live that says this is a better way of living. And this will poison you if you engage in it. It's unhealthy. It's self-harm to engage in this kind of sin. And of course, here's what we know. When we do those things over and over and over again, the toxic buildup happens in our heart and our arteries harden because we are hardening our hearts through our actions. And the harder our hearts that soil, the less we're receptive to anything God has to say. And in all honesty, I can recognize a version of my heart in this hardened soil. I don't know about you. Now, my particular form of it, my version of it, is probably a little different than yours. Here's one of my versions, is I sanitize my hard heart at times through what I like to make myself feel better about by calling it thoughtful skepticism, which is ridiculous. You should have laughed at that because that's a ridiculous thing to say. And yet, I do think, oh, I'm just being a skeptic, just being thoughtful. And really what it is, it's hardness. And the more skeptical I become, the more I know my heart's hard. Not much is penetrating my heart. And quite frankly, I find this the most unattractive of the four hearts. There's something about it I don't want at all. Makes for a hard human being. And I wonder, is your heart hardening? Has the life-giving seed that God is sowing become, at best, uninteresting? Anybody? Uninteresting? Or even worse, completely irrelevant, rarely producing much good. Our lives depend on the health of our hearts. And it's time we check to see whether the soil's hard. Heart number two, the shallow or the superficial heart. This is in verses 5 and 6, and then later Jesus expounds on it in verses 16 and 17. So it said, other seed fell on shallow soil and underlying rock. Now, in Palestine, much of the land is this thin 2 or 3 inches of soil over limestone bedrock. So some of the seed falls, the hot sun does its job as the seed goes into the soil, and they sprout kind of feverishly, quickly. But then as the same sun beats down and plants, the roots reach down in this kind of like desperate need for nutrients. And what ends up happening is they go too deep below that thin veneer of soil and they hit bedrock. And the soil is just too shallow or superficial for it to give a robust life to what's trying to grow. And therefore, it dies. It can't sustain the life as the roots reach down deep in order for nutrients. And this is a shallow and superficial soil that Jesus says doesn't give and sustain life, a life-giving heart. Richard Foster, an author, goes so far as to say that superficiality, right, shallowness, is just the commonplace of our age. It's the curse of our age. We have lost and are losing our depth. Maybe some of us have never had that depth before. See, the question's not whether you're intelligent or talented. You are. The question's not whether you're energetic or physically healthy. You are, most of you. The question's not whether you're financially stable or even just good looking. I'm looking at you, I can tell you. You're handsome people. Congratulations. That's not the question. The question is, are we people of depth and substance? Or have we replaced depth and substance with a bunch of other things? What makes a person shallow or superficial? One answer is, among others, is that we don't think much farther than ourselves. We're self-focused people. We're self-interested. The Journal of American Medical Association reported that people who live in each successive generation of the 20th century, we have actually proof that each generation was 3 times more likely to experience depression than the people in the generation immediately prior to them. That is an astounding fact. Despite the rise in the availability of the mental health profession, people are becoming more and more susceptible to depression. Statistics tell us that since 2012, reported cases of depressive episodes have surged 145% in our country with our youth, despite access to all the professionals that we have. Among U.S. college students, diagnoses of anxiety have increased by 134% in the same time period. That is, not just you might be a little anxious, that is an official diagnosis that accompanies medication and other things with it. Now, I am not ignorant enough to be reductionistic or to say that the only cause for this type of tragic increase is due to our self-interest alone. There are a lot of factors to take into account. I am with you on that. However, it is certainly an underpinning catalyst that creates this vicious cycle of obsession about oneself. And it certainly, without a doubt, contributes to superficiality. According to some cognitive studies, up to 60 to 70% of daily thoughts are self-focused. Now, you say, well, that doesn't mean much because I don't know how many thoughts I have a day. Well, I'm glad you asked, because here's the answer. That could translate roughly, I didn't come up with this, I'm looking to the professionals to tell me, 30 to 40,000 thoughts a day about oneself. I just think about that. I don't know about you, but I haven't started my day off with a notebook and started counting thought one, thought two, thought three. This is taking a lot of thought of study, but 30 to 40,000 thoughts about ourselves a day? This includes, of course, planning and self-criticism and daydreaming and reflection and all those things. But here's the psychological consensus. We think about ourselves a lot. But we're obsessed with ourselves. And so have we tried to solve this problem? This problem of shallow superficiality, of self-focus. How have we tried to solve it? Here's one of the ways we've solved it. If you're empty, what do? Fulfill yourself. If you're stressed, learn how to take care of yourself. If you're in a job interview, believe in yourself. If someone criticizes or puts you down, love yourself. If authority tells you what to do, don't worry, just be yourself. And I'll add one, when it comes to our faith, oftentimes we focus on nothing but ourselves. We have become obsessed with ourselves. And this kind of narrow, myopic view of life creates shallow superficiality and depressed people obsessed with ourselves and think no further than our own noses. Sadly, I can recognize this heart in me too. And I admit, I have a lot of thoughts about myself. Sometimes as I'm listening to myself think, that's called metacognition. When I'm paying attention to how I'm thinking, man, am I thinking a lot about myself. It's kind of gross. I don't know if you paid attention to how much you're thinking about yourself. It may be killing us. It may be creating us into superficial people. And I personally find this one the saddest of the hearts because it's this desperate reach for something greater than ourselves, and yet we go no farther than filling it with us. Is your heart shallow? Or maybe the better question is, how truly shallow is your heart? Heart 3, the cluttered, distracted heart. Verse 7, verse 18 to 19, other seed fell among thorns and grew up and choked out the tender plants, so they produced no grain. This one's interesting because no farmer in his right mind would sow seed where thorns were visible. That just would not make sense, right? So here's the idea. The idea is the thorns have been cut off at the surface, but their roots are still in the ground. So when the seed is sown and then it's watered and it germinates, the entrenched thorns also sprout and also grow. You see, that makes sense why that would happen. And when they grow at the same time as that seed, it chokes it out and it prevents it from actually becoming what it needs to be. So in verse 19, Jesus says the thorns are, quote, the worries of this life. This is a heart that is deceived by the lie of wealth and is consumed with status and achievement. So the phrase, the deceitfulness of wealth, it becomes synonymous in our culture with the old saying, keeping up with the Joneses. Anybody know that phrase? Yeah? That came from a 1913 comic strip of the same name depicting a family struggle to maintain a lifestyle comparative to the wealthy neighbors, the Joneses. Interestingly enough, they were making a point through comedy, which is the way comedy works, isn't it? But keeping up with the Joneses has now been replaced with another phrase, and let's see, do you know it? Keeping up with the Kardashians. You were afraid to say that in church, weren't you? Yeah, I caught you. I heard it. You know, I know you. You know me. I mean, I said it. And of course, the Kardashians are these women with endless amounts of plastic surgery procedures and exposing their bodies and amassing crazy amounts of wealth by essentially doing nothing productive. And we're funding them, people. It's so strange. And so we feel this need and this pressure to match or exceed the possessions and the status of other people, don't we? You know, Amazons are not just people of Greek mythology, nor are they just people who live in the Amazon. It's us. I mean, we're the Amazonians, aren't we? We are purchasing things we do not need to impress people we do not like with money we do not have, because somehow it's going to give us a full heart. And it doesn't. Wealth is like a siren. It promises us a fulfilled heart, yet leaves us empty, thereby choking out the very thing our hearts are desperate to have. It's interesting that the phrase in verse 19, the deceitfulness of wealth, it can be translated a little bit more literally, and it is the distractions of this age. That's interesting. There might not be a better phrase to actually call us than people who are distracted, right? I don't know if you've heard about the new economy. Heard this? It wasn't talked about in the most recent political campaign. And by the way, nor will it ever be talked about. It's called the attention economy. It actually is a real thing. The attention economy is the idea that human attention is a limited resource that's increasingly scarce. Our screens of every variety and size have enabled this constant tsunami where everything is immediately available, vying for a limited amount of attention. So you and I have a limited amount of attention. It is not endless. So companies use marketing and branding to capture our attention and in order to maintain profitability. And they're coming up with all kinds of inventive ways. Some of you, actually, that might be your job. Some people between first service and second actually said, I know a little bit about this, right? I am told, literally, that we are bombarded with 4,000 advertisements a day. Can you imagine if we logged those? Now, I've noticed a lot, but I've become immune, and that's what they're trying to overcome. They're trying to overcome our immunity to them. We're so flooded with them. 4,000. As I was looking into the attention economy, I came across an article, and this is going to divide the room into two groups. So just see which group you're in. Here's the title of the article. It's going to tell you a lot. Mr. Beast, the Mozart of the attention economy. All right? Some of you have questions. You don't know who Mr. Beast is. And some of you are like, I know Mr. Beast. I've watched him, right? Okay, there it is. So my question, though, by the way, is those of you who know Mr. Beast, if you know who Mozart was. Okay, that was a cheap shot, but it was fun. I had to take it. Mr. Beast is a YouTube channel star, of course, where he posts his increasing elaborate and expensively produced videos. He has 400 million subscribers. 400 million. By the way, if you're counting, that's more than the population of the United States of America and the equivalent to the total number of native English speakers currently alive in the world. And if you're also keeping count, that's over 100 million more subscribers than Taylor Swift's Instagram page. So take that, Tay-Tay, right? Yep. Mr. Beast is bigger. He's awesome. And by the way, that doesn't account for those of us who are just doing a flyby to Mr. Beast's account and watching a video here and there. He's the Mozart of the attention economy. He knows how to get it. He knows how to keep it. He knows how to keep you coming back and keep you from doing the other things that we should be doing. Total daily screen time, by the way, including streaming TV, internet, and computers and apps, can reach now. Have you heard the most recent figure? 8 hours, 34 minutes a day. That, by the way, that's more than we do anything else, basically, even sleep. And I'm putting myself in this category. We are addicted to the dopamine drip of our distractions, and that's the understatement of the year. Early morning phone scrolling, late night phone scrolling, all day phone scrolling. It just simply interferes with and even prevents our ability to pay attention to our hearts, out of which all the issues of life flow. And thus, we find ourselves shallow, superficial, people lacking depth. And I find this the most subtle of the four hearts, as our busy distractedness numbs us into thinking that we're fine when we're actually empty. So, how cluttered and distracted is your heart? Heart number four. While this has sounded objectively negative up to this point, Jesus lands on a positive note, and I'm really glad about that. This is the receptive or the productive heart. And I just want to read verse 8 again. Just let it hear the compounding crescendo of words that shows momentum in verse, heart number 4. This is what he says in verse 8. Still other seeds fell on fertile soil, and they sprouted, they grew, and they produced a crop that was 30, 60, and even 100 times as much as that had been planted. And who doesn't want that kind of heart? I mean, I know I do. But here's what I find so enigmatic about Jesus. He gives us this diagnostic parable without a detailed change management plan in order to find the receptive heart. Does anybody find that interesting, weird, frustrating at all? I do a little bit. I'm like, come on, man, where's the detailed plan? Instead, here's what Jesus says. Verse 9, I'm going to read it again. Here's what he says. Here's how it goes from one of those three to the receptive heart. Anyone with ears to hear should listen and understand. That's your change management plan. What? Really, Jesus? That's it? Here's what Jesus is doing. Jesus used parables like riddles not to confuse, but to invite. They conceal truth from the indifferent people, but reveal truth to the hungry. They say to you, if you really want to understand, come closer. Come closer. Keep coming. Those who lean in and wrestle with the meaning will be given more. It's a guarantee. But those who don't care will remain confused and indifferent. And we live in a noisy, noisy world. And God doesn't shout. He whispers. He tells stories. He draws us in. Because if you're interested in seeking, he'll give you more. I want to end by imprinting on your mind maybe what might be called a symbol of hope. Let's take a look at this image. You have all seen this, right? Anybody recognize this? Anybody been downtown, right? This is the tree, the 100-foot-tall beech tree planted in 1932 in downtown Greenville and Falls Park. Hopefully you've not carved your initials into the roots. That's not a good thing, but it's technically called the Medusa tree. I don't particularly love that name because in Greek mythology, Medusa was a female with snakes for hair who could turn males into stone who looked at her. So I vote no on that name, right? Otherwise, the tree is known as the root tree. Not as aggressive, but kind of lame. Anyway, it's gone through some challenging times as it was ignored and uncared for through World War II. For obvious reasons, it suffered. And it was damaged when Furman Way, which is the part of the now called the Swamp Rabbit Trail that goes right in front of it, was created. And so the soil dropped down. It started losing what it was feeding off of. And so you can see the roots started reaching for good soil to give it life. And somehow it has survived and turned into a bit of an icon for our city. So, I would prefer to vote out Medusa and the root tree. I'd like to call it the hope tree. Because no matter what soil that tree has faced, it's continued to live and grow. And here's what I want to tell you. No matter the soil type of your heart today, that can be the result of your life. Just keep listening to Jesus. Anyone with ears to hear should listen and understand. Your life depends on the health of your heart. So care for it with all diligence. Shall we pray? So, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on us and give us faith to believe. Give us ears to hear. Give us soil of hearts that are receptive to you and your good word to us. Through Jesus Christ, we pray.